You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Meg O'Connor, senior reporter with The Appeal, on the story of the killing of Jacob Harris. Then Kathy Hempstead, senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, on the rollbacks of Medicaid and CHIP eligibility as we exit a COVID state of emergency. Meanwhile, Trump declares he's ready for a perp walk. Also, new report, special counsel claims in a court filing that Trump misled his own attorneys on having stolen secret documents. And just like that, Republican voters are already turning on Tiny D. A little too sanctimonious. U.S. sending M1 A1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. It's day two of the L.A. school shutdown as school workers strike for a living wage and are joined in solidarity by teachers. New research finds anti-Semitism has doubled on Twitter under Elon Musk. TikTok CEO to testify on the Hill tomorrow. Arkansas and Georgia pass anti-trans laws while Uganda makes it illegal to be gay. Fed meets today, torn between protecting banks and attacking labor. And lastly, Florida Don't Say Gay author pleads guilty to COVID relief fraud. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is the day in which 93% of our revenue is derived from our co-host, Emma Viglin's coined catchphrase, which has caught on amazingly, and here she is to deliver it, putting more cash in our coffers.
It is hump day.
There it is, folks. Use that wildly every time. I don't know. This joke never gets old.
People love it. People want it to go on for, like, I think years longer.
Honestly, I never understood your love for it, Sam, but I'll take it, I guess.
You know, like if we had to deliver it like every second day or third day, it would be a problem. Mm-hmm. But I get a full week from recovering from how my feeling of like, God, enough with that.
Also, from what I gather from your comedy career, this is pretty much how you like jokes to land on audiences, to sort of, you know, grate at them a little bit.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
That's true. There is some truth to that. That, like, when when this joke starts actually causing people to bleed from their ears, that's when I know it has landed. Let's get into this. I mean, it's a really interesting moment here in terms of the Trump situation, because between what is happening in New York City with the Manhattan District Attorney's case of Trump lying on his business forms and essentially fraudulently trying to hide the hush money payments as a business expense. What's going on in Georgia, where it appears that it very likely could end up in indictments down there for the election interference that Trump was involved with. I'm really trying to threaten officials to get them to overturn the results of a of a presidential election. Seems like a big deal. And also the fact that Trump was lying to the DOJ and via his own lawyers in this stolen secret documents case. Again, that one, more than any other, is just like one where he like clearly could have just walked away from this without an issue, but there, for some reason, was desperate to keep these documents and to lie about it repeatedly. And it's quite possible, like, there could be jail time associated with really any one of these, of these crimes that he allegedly committed. He's going to go through a trial. I, you know, maybe they can delay the trial to the point where it's like after the election, but he's going to run and he's going to run so under indictment. And he seems to think that it's probably going to help him. I have no doubt that it would help him in a Republican primary.
That's why he wants the perp walk optics, right? He wants that image splashed everywhere so he can say, see, it is a witch hunt. They're trying to, you know, come after me for a porn star affair, which is why that is the least, I think, you know, strong foundation to actually go after this guy and nail him on something.
Right. And, you know, maybe he'll do that thing where, like, put me into a big tub of water and see if I float. This is such a witch hunt. But
no one wants to see
that. You've got Ron DeSantis now. Like, the more he gets out there and talks, it seems like the less the Republicans like him.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't prove
Republican
that there's a direct
voters. I mean, the established Republican power players are desperate for this indictment to actually bring Trump down because they thought DeSantis would be a formidable challenge, and that's just not happening. It's just not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I can't prove that there's a direct relationship between DeSantis going out there and people actually hearing him talk and being so sanctimonious. And his, now he's reached, according to Morning Consult, the lowest level of his approval tied for it since they started basically, you know, measuring it. And he can't be too happy about that. But here is Tucker Carlson asking for the impossible. And we know he hates Donald Trump. Right. I mean, we know he hates Donald Trump, but at the same time, he also knows that his audience wouldn't like it if he said he hated Donald Trump. So he's in sort of a bit of a jam.
Yeah, he's a destroyer, but he won't destroy us.
Another day of rumors and thinly sourced news stories. Ooh, what's new? These about when and where Donald Trump will be arrested, fingerprinted, and photographed against a cinder block wall for his mugshot. How much of this is true? Once again, we cannot say. Here's what we know. A Soros-funded prosecutor in New York, a man who ran on the promise to indict Trump, seems to be working hard to indict Trump, indicting him for a crime that no one even pretends is a crime, including the federal agency that has already investigated it and declared it not a crime. So in Manhattan tomorrow, what will certainly be an overwhelmingly liberal grand jury will meet. And unless something unexpected happens, Democrats will have taken the unprecedented step of using a corrupt justice system to take out the front runner in the Republican presidential field in a presidential race. And if that happens, America will never be the same. You've got to hope that for the sake of the country, the Biden White House, which will be running against Trump, will put the country above partisanship and stop this. That Merrick Garland at DOJ will issue a very public statement saying that this is wrong, which it is, and therefore preserve for our grandchildren our justice system. As a fact, that doesn't seem to be happening.
I mean, first off, the idea that it's Democrats doing this. No, it's an attorney general district attorney in Manhattan is doing this.
The Soros-funded one?
Yes, it is the non-Soros bankrolled prosecutors in Georgia who are also doing this. Right. Like, it's going to be interesting to see how they're going to finagle that.
And try to act like it's not happening anywhere but the New York, I think, is probably going to be the play.
Indeed. And the idea that in a great cry for lack of authoritarianism. This is the one night, I guess, a week that Tucker takes off from saying that Joe Biden's an authoritarian and then begs him to come out and somehow squash the prosecution in mm-hmm. New York City.
Yeah, well, he says it while doing his other favorite pastime, which is dog whistling to white supremacists by saying that Soros-funded thing, which is just like, the Jews control this guy, don't you see? Also tipping his hat to Trump, who was the tweeting out Soros funded, then DeSantis says Soros funded, then Tucker says Soros funded. So they're still following the big guy. They're still following the leader here, even when, you know, they're trying behind the scenes to do a coup d'etat. It's not happening.
It's not happening. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Meg O'Connor, senior reporter with The Appeal, about this horrible story out of Phoenix. And then we'll be talking to Kathy Hempstead about the implications of the COVID emergency ending in terms of Medicaid and the CHIP program. But first, a word from our sponsor. It's been, I would say, a week since I've taken Z-Biotics. Sometimes I can anticipate a situation where I need to, and when I can, I do. Z-Biotics is a pre-alcohol probiotic. It is genetically engineered, probiotic. And what you do is you drink it. It's about yay big, the size of a thumb. You know, it's a small, like, little shot bottle, I guess. And what it does is essentially puts a probiotic in your belly. You do this the night before you're going out to have a drink or many drinks. And what it does is make sure that the next day you're not a piece of luggage. And it's been very helpful for me. And apparently the way it works is, and I always thought that the primary driver of why you feel bad the next day is because of dehydration after your drink. But it turns out that alcohol creates a toxic byproduct in your gut. And this probiotic, if you drink it beforehand, then you have a drink or a couple of drinks and you get a decent night sleep. And the next morning, you can go out. You want to work out? You'll be able to work out. I mean, assuming you could work out the day before. It's not one of those things like, you know, doctor, will I be able to play the violin? Yes, should. Didn't. I never could before, that type of thing. But if you want to work out, you can work out. If you want to do a podcast, you can do a podcast. If you've got to get to work or you just want to be sharp in general, you feel great. This was a big lifesaver for me on the Nation Cruise because I did it as a measure, like a practice, essentially, because I knew, you know, I'm going to dinner. I'm on a boat, and then tomorrow I got to do some talk or an interview, and I didn't want to be messed up for it. And it was great. But every night, like if I'm going to a party or something like that, you can get 15% off your first order of Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic by clicking the link in our podcast or YouTube subscription and using the code Majority at checkout. Go to zbiotics.com/majority. That's zbiotics.com/majority. You will get 15% off your first order. And you'll see that stuff really works. It's great. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Meg O'Connor, senior reporter with The Appeal. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Meg O'Connor. She's a senior reporter with The Appeal, which incidentally you can find at theappeal.org. Just a an excellent outfit that covers all sorts of criminal justice issues. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the situation in which Jacob Harris was shot to death by a Phoenix police officer about 4 years ago.
Yeah, so in 2019, 19-year-old Jacob Harris was shot and killed by a Phoenix police officer. It happened after police had already been surveilling Harris and three of his friends for about 12 hours. They had plenty of opportunities to stop Harris and his friends. They suspected the group of being involved in a string of armed robberies at convenience stores and drive-thrus. But they didn't take any of those opportunities. Instead, they chose, several police officers said in a deposition that they allowed a robbery to occur, and then they chose to do a high-stakes maneuver to stop the vehicle that Jacob Harris was in, at which point he ran out of the car, he fled, he ran for all of 2 seconds before a police officer shot at him 11 times in the back.
It was established that was it ever established that they were responsible for this series of robberies? They clearly committed a robbery that night. Has it been established that they were responsible for the other robberies?
That has been something that I haven't looked into as much, though I have seen, you know, all three pleaded. They took plea deals and they did plead guilty to committing some of the robberies that they were accused of committing. We reviewed thousands of pages of records for this case, but I was not able to get the Phoenix Police Department's report on the robbery investigation. But they ultimately, I believe, each of the kids pled to only one or two of the robbery instances, or maybe three tops, and they were accused. They had a 128 count indictment against them for various robbery charges.
Okay, so let's start with let's cover that day, because basically the story is that the Phoenix police are looking for what they perceive to be like a group of kids who, and they're not all kids. Some were 20, but some were 14. And there were four of them, if I'm not mistaken. And they're looking for them, in regards to this series of robberies, that as far as I can tell from your reporting, nobody was, hurt in any of these robberies, but they were, you know, robbing like fast food places and whatnot. And so they settle on this one guy who had one conviction in the past, and they start surveilling them. And we only know so much about what their plan was because mm-hmm. they deleted all of their sort of internal exchanges. All right, so start with just sort of like what they did, and then we'll talk about why we don't know really what their plan was.
Sure, yeah. So basically, a robbery detective with the Phoenix Police Department, his name is Jacob Rasmussen. He is apparently standard procedure for robbery detectives to look at robbery reports that they have and try to identify similarities. So in this case, he was looking for cases involving Whataburgers and Circle K's, cases involving young men of color of a kind of smaller stature, but also some of them were taller. Some of them involved a red or maroon SUV, others involved a white car. So there was a big variety in what he was looking for, but he kind of honed in on the Circle K's and Whataburgers, and he asked for other police departments in the Valley in Maricopa County if they had any similar cases. The Glendale Police Department sent over a case to him involving 20-year-old Jeremiah Triplett, who had been arrested for robbing a Circle K for, like, you know, a bottle of Hennessy and some cigarettes back in September. So the next day, police started surveilling, it seems like, Triplett and perhaps others. There are some questions remaining from the records in terms of who they surveilled? Was it just Triplett? Because the records that I have begin with Jacob's death, Jacob Harris's death. So it's related to the surveillance of him. And there were other people with Jeremiah Triplett when he was arrested back in September. So I'm unclear whether they surveilled those other people, but they at least surveilled this group, which involved these four kids. And there were other people that were photographed with them that day. They used an aircraft in addition to several on-the-ground police officers to surveil the group. They ended up watching them for something like 12 hours.
Can I just say, too, at this point, what I was struck by, I mean, this isn't even really the point of the story, but I was really shocked at the amount of resources that they seem to have available to surveil these teenagers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're using an airplane. They're using like multiple police officers. And again, there's every reason to believe that we just know this story of who they were surveilling. But if this main guy that they were sort of like tipped off to, there could have been two or three other groups of people mm-hmm. that they were surveilling as well. I was sort of struck by that, but continue. So these guys, they're surveilling them over the course of the day. They get the sense, the police do, that they're, prepping for a robbery. Mm-hmm. They follow them to the fast food place, and they witness the robbery. About what time did they witness the police witness the robbery?
Mm-hmm. It was just around midnight.
And in the piece, you make it clear that if they had wanted to arrest any members of these guys, there was a couple of things over the course of the day that they could mm-hmm. have. Somebody was drinking illegally. Somebody had an air gun that mm-hmm. they could have assumed was an actual weapon. Somebody else did have a weapon, I think, and was on probation, was a Tribbett.
Yeah, and, which he was later charged with, yeah.
And so they had reason, but they wanted to let this play out so that they could mm-hmm. Arrest them on robbery charges, which, if they're really worried about what these guys are going to do when they go in for a robbery, you're risking the lives of the people who work at this restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wanted to watch the robbery occur because they say that they didn't think they had probable cause for the like couple of dozen, maybe up to 29 robberies that they thought this group was previously involved with, which is, it's a, as you mentioned before, the level of surveillance for this group of people was pretty outstanding. At one point, the surveillance officer in the aircraft was asked to get approval from the FAA to stay in the air. That's how long he was up there. And yet they also didn't think that they had probable cause.
That seems like sort of at odds with each other a little bit, it seems to me. But be that as it may, they witnessed the robbery. And then what happens?
They witnessed the robbery. As you mentioned, it involved, scaring the restaurant workers, though no one was physically harmed in any of these cases. They did say that they were traumatized and scared. The group left. It was three people: Jacob Harris, who's 19, Jeremiah Triplett, who's 20, and 14-year-old Johnny Reed. And then they got into the car of 19-year-old Soraya Busani, who drove away from the Whataburger. Police followed them, both in their cars and in an aircraft. They were unmarked cars. It wasn't a high-speed chase with lights or sirens. The police just followed them silently for about 10 minutes until one police officer got very close to the end of the car, to the Busani's Honda Passport, and deployed a device that's known as the grappler. It's like a tether, like net type situation that deploys in the car and seizes the tire so that it grinds to a halt. So they use this device called the grappler. The car seizes to a stop.
And I'm sorry for 1 second.
Yeah.
This was the first time, in my understanding, that they had used the grappler. So
in a professional setting, yeah. He had done it a few times in practice, but they had just acquired the tool, yeah.
At this point, this all sounds like we're gonna. This is an opportunity for us to test out some of our new toys on some level, right? Like, I mean, they waited 10 minutes as opposed to like as if it almost like they wanted them in an area where we can try out the grappler.
Well, we can catch them in the crime and use the new toys right. Exactly. It's more about their perception of themselves as cops, like in the dangerous situation.
Yeah. And they definitely had an opportunity to do other kinds of stops. Something called a street jump was discussed, where it's just several police vehicles that come up and stop the car. They decided not to do that. Even though Busani had just stopped at a red light before they deployed the grappler. They also said multiple times that, they wouldn't have stopped the robbery as it occurred in the Whataburger because it could put people's lives at risk, which makes sense, but it put people's lives at risk to allow the robbery to occur in the first place when police could have arrested the group at any of the 12 hours prior while they were watching them, particularly because they later charged Jeremiah Triplett with one of the offenses they saw him committing earlier in the day, which is having a weapon when he was a convicted felon.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so they stopped the car with this grappler toy that they have. And at that moment, we have video, but it's thermal video, right? I mean, just to explain what that is so that people know. I mean, mm-hmm. People probably have seen it. They just don't know what it is.
Yeah, so there is video from the aircraft that's thermal video captured by, I forget the particular name of the camera, but it's a pretty impressive camera that captured the whole incident. Apparently, none of the officers who were there that night were wearing body cams.
Is that required of Phoenix officers?
It is now.
Well, it was not at the time.
I think this particular unit, the Special Assignments Unit, which is the Phoenix Police Department's equivalent of SWAT at the time, did not have body cameras, though other departments did. And apparently the SAU has now received them.
Okay, so we have thermal video footage of this. What happens when the car is pulled over?
So when the car stops, it's obviously, I talked to some of the people who were inside the vehicle at the time. It's pretty confusing. They didn't see police cars. They were unmarked. The car ceases to a stop. It turns kind of to the right when that happens. One officer Christopher Burtz, throws a flashbang, which emits an insanely bright light and a loud sound that sounds like a gunshot. In that moment, 19-year-old Jacob Harris opens the rear passenger door of the Honda Passport, which is near the side of the road, kind of ahead of officers Burtz and Norman. And he runs out of the vehicle. He is running away from the officers. The video shows him just running for, I think he takes something like 7 steps within 2 seconds before the officers shot at him 11 times. 2 of them, both from Burtz's AR-15 style rifle, hit Jacob in the back and pierced his heart and lungs and intestines.
So they go ahead, Sam.
No.
No, I mean, just to clarify, they were using AR-15s. And there's this kind of there's conflicting testimony about what Jacob had on him, right? What are the cops saying was their justification for using such a intense weaponry?
So Officer Burtz, who was the one who ultimately killed Jacob, had an AR-15. Officer Norman had a handgun. All of his shots missed. Jacob is accused of having a handgun himself. And their justification is kind of layered. Obviously, police can say in this situation that because he was allegedly holding a gun, they feared for their lives. But at the end of the day, Jacob's father, Roland Harris, sued the city of Phoenix and Officer Christopher Burtz, and a federal court, he's appealing the case, but a federal court dismissed it based on the fact that Arizona law permits law enforcement officers to use deadly force simply when someone has committed a felony and is fleeing. So you don't even need to be afraid for your life. You can kill someone for committing a felony and fleeing.
What was the flashbang about? Is that standard operating procedure? Once we have stopped the car, first thing we do, we throw a flashbang?
Yeah, so in his deposition, Christopher Byrd said that he did it to try to keep the occupants of the vehicle inside the vehicle. This was a point of contention in the deposition because Burtz had taught other officers on how to deploy weaponry and including flashbangs. And you are taught to let other officers know when you're going to do it because it can be confusing and it does sound like a gunshot. Another officer in the police report on Jacob Harris's death said himself that he thought that the suspects in the vehicle had fired a gun because it's confusing. But he did not alert anyone to the fact that he was about to deploy a flashbang. He said in his deposition that it was, you know, a very fast-paced moment where he was making second-by-second decisions. But yeah.
He claims he hadn't told any of the other officers, right? I mean, because we can't establish what they were saying to each other just before this happened because they deleted all of their WhatsApp communication shortly after they killed Jacob Harris, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so we don't really know what their plan was. It seems odd to me that you've been surveilling somebody for 12 hours. You take the time to watch them commit a crime, which you know that they're doing. You have 10 minutes in which you're in pursuit of them. You know you're going to deploy this new thing to capture the tire. And then out of the blue, you decide, you know what? Flashbang. I mean, that just sounds super, super hard to believe. That was not premeditated. And then you have to ask why, and the idea that they wouldn't have communicated that with the other officers, you have to ask why are they denying, why deny that they knew that? I mean, if the rest of this stuff makes sense to somebody, so be it. But the people inside the car, did they know, at what point did they realize that these people were police?
Mm-hmm. There's some dispute over that. Police have alleged that Jeremiah Triplett knew that that police were following them, although their statements to that fact have been kind of inconsistent and confusing. They claim that Jeremiah, when they arrested the other people in the vehicle, Soraya, Jeremiah, and Johnny afterwards, only Jeremiah talked to the police. And Jeremiah said something to the effect of he didn't say exactly that he knew police were following them, but police said that he said he told the others to be smooth or see smooth. Alternately, they have quoted both of those things and claimed that that means that he knew police were following them, although it seems like saying be smooth or see smooth would be a pretty normal thing to say after you've committed a crime. But Soraya and Johnny have said that they didn't know that police were behind them.
So Jacob gets shot to death, and it's also just sort of brutal. After they shoot him those times, they keep shooting him with rubber bullets and deploy a dog on him, and he's dead within an hour.
Yeah, it's awful.
And then the three people in the car end up going to jail, not just because they committed this robbery, and one of them is a 14-year-old being housed in an adult facility. They go to jail for years and years and years and years because they're faced with, they're told by the prosecutor, and we should also say they spend 3 years because they can't afford bail. So they spend 3 years in jail before their trial, even, and which gives you a sense of, like, you know, what kind of quality of defense that they could probably muster when it came time to a plea bargain. And they go to jail not just for the robbery, but also for the murder of Jacob Harris. Is that right?
Yeah. So after police killed Jacob Harris, the three were arrested and yeah, they were all in jail for 3 years, held on. Jeremiah and Soraya were held on $1 million bond. Johnny, who's 14, was held on a $500,000 bond, but none of them could afford that. And they were charged with felony murder, which is a law that allows people to be charged with someone else's murder if someone died during the commission of a felony. So even though everyone agrees the police killed Jacob Harris, the prosecutor's office ultimately determined that the police officer did nothing wrong, but that the Jacob Harris's three friends, including the 14-year-old, were responsible for his death.
What is the commission of the what felony was committed in Jacob in that moment? I understand the felony was the robbery, but does that last? Like, if I commit a robbery yesterday, am I still in the presence of a commission, or are they saying they're fleeing from a robbery?
That's actually an interesting point, because that is something that Soraya's defense attorney brought up at one point. He argued that the kind of chain or the linkage of these events had been broken by the fact that it was 10 minutes since the felony occurred. And I believe that prosecutors, this, you know, didn't make it in this story, so I don't remember it as well. But I believe that prosecutors argued that they were still committing a felony because they were fleeing, but no one was charged with fleeing law enforcement. They hit them with ultimately over 140 criminal charges, and fleeing was not one of them.
And there's no indication that they even knew the police were following them. So how can they be fleeing the police at that point? Mm. They didn't even know that it was necessarily the police deploying a flashbang when they stop and run out of the car. And it also occurs to me that, like, I mean, if this is, I understand this is the law, and that, you know, maybe this is a legislative problem too, but what's to prevent the police from doing this as a matter of course? If we catch people fleeing, you know, leaving the scene of a robbery, we have every right under Arizona law to shoot them dead, and then we can blame everybody around them will be responsible for this guy's death.
Yeah, it's an alarming precedent, and it has already happened with one of the officers involved in this case. One of the two officers who shot at Jacob Harris previously shot and killed someone while they were, I think, stealing a car and involved in a police chase, shot and killed the man. The man's girlfriend was in the vehicle with him at the time. The girlfriend was charged with his murder, and I think was sentenced to maybe 7 years or in prison or something like that.
It's just an amazing case. People should look into it. Is there any, like, I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that had these guys had, like, I don't know, better representation, that there would have been some type of mitigation on this prosecution?
If they had been able to afford, like, high-powered attorneys, of course they would not have been coerced by the prosecutor's office to take these shocking plea deals. The Jeremiah Triplett, who is 20, is serving 30 years in prison, which is very concerning because he has a serious health condition that has required 6 brain surgeries in his lifetime already. So he's definitely going to need more during his incarceration. And as we all know, prison healthcare is not exactly great. And Johnny, who's 14, was sentenced to 15 years, more years than he had even been alive at the time when this occurred. So I think that if they had better representation, sure, they probably could have fought the charges, but it's also, you know, just kind of par for the course for the Maricopa County Attorney's Office to, level such egregious charges against people. And had they not been charged with Jacob's murder that the police committed, they certainly would not be serving such a long sentence. The top charge that they all pled to was either manslaughter or negligent homicide. So that is one of the things that made their sentences so long.
Are the police, are they facing any type of charges, disciplinary action, anything to that effect, for deleting all of their contact with each other in the moments leading up to that thing, because they're supposed to keep those records, aren't they?
Yeah, that's a good question. To be clear, we obtained radio transcript that shows a communications between police officers saying, can you throw the 52 squad, which is what Burtz, who killed Jacob Harris, was on, onto WhatsApp. During the civil suit brought by Roland Harris, he asked for those records, those WhatsApp records. Burtz said he didn't have them and that he deleted them and didn't know.
What does that mean to throw on the special squad onto WhatsApp? What does that mean?
It means to, as Burtz explained in his deposition, it means just to send the information that they were talking about on the police radio onto WhatsApp so that all the squad members who are using WhatsApp to communicate can view it on there.
So that they can delete it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those records are allegedly deleted and we will never know what they said. Roland Harris, Jacob's father, speculates that they could have been planning or covering something up. But yeah, as far as I know, Bert says, you know, it's cleared of any wrongdoing and the killing of Jacob Harris, both as a matter of Phoenix Police Department policy and criminally, but I don't know if he was ever investigated for deleting those records.
It's a crazy story. You did a great job in the reporting of this. You know, congratulations to you, but it really is incredibly disturbing. Meg O'Connor, we will put a link to your piece. Police killed his son. Prosecutors charged the teen's friends with his murder on theappeal.org. Really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Kathy Hempstead. She's a senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation about the implications of the COVID emergency order being rescinded in this coming April and what it's going to mean for people's who are on CHIP or kids who are on CHIP or folks on Medicaid. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Kathy Hempstead. She is a senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And Kathy, welcome to the program. We have seen over the course of COVID via a couple of different relief bills, if you will, the last of which was the American Rescue Act, all sorts of funding for things like a child tax credit for children, expansion of the SNAP program. We saw extended unemployment. We saw expanded unemployment benefits. All of these things now have gone away, despite the fact that we know they had a great impact in reducing poverty writ large, and particularly child poverty in this country, up to 35%, of maybe 40% of child poverty was taken care of by this. One other aspect of this was the expansion of CHIP and Medicaid, which got people onto health insurance. Tell us under what auspices did that CHIP and Medicaid expansion happen, and how?
Sure, that's a good question. When the public health emergency went into effect in January of 2020, it created a bunch of different sort of new health flexibilities, which in many ways, you know, as you kind of alluded to with some of the other things you mentioned, increased equity and really helped people out. I mean, one of the things it did was allow people who were uninsured to get care, testing, treatment for COVID at no cost, and eliminated cost sharing for COVID treatment and ultimately vaccinations, but tests for people who were insured. And then another super important thing that was part of that public health emergency was to create this continuous coverage rule in Medicaid, which didn't exactly expand eligibility, but it eliminated the normal process by which states sort of continuously reassess eligibility, so that some people lose eligibility and are, you know, disenrolled sort of at different points throughout the year. So in a way, it kind of shut the back door sort of for Medicaid so that people could come in, but nobody would be forced to leave. So over the course of the last 2 years, enrollment in Medicaid has grown a lot. And as a result, we have an all-time low uninsurance rate, which is really terrific.
So the COVID relief, I mean, the COVID emergency that was declared by, I guess, the CDC, what agency is it? Health and Human Services then has the regulatory ability to waive or to mandate that states no longer make these reassessments where they basically the reassessments where they kick people off the rolls of Medicaid because maybe. What are the reasons why they would get kicked off? I mean, they're not poor enough anymore, or what? I mean, walk through us what like the typical ones, because I imagine they change state by state, which is also the part of the problem.
I mean, right? It's you know, there are a million different details to this, you know, going state by state. So I'll just sort of try to give you the big picture. You know, with a context that state eligibility rules for Medicaid are different. You know, famously, as we know, most states expanded Medicaid eligibility under the ACA to low income adults, but you know, there's a handful of states that have not. So that's a big eligibility difference.
11 Florida for one is not one. I think 900,000 or 600,000 people are going to be thrown off the rolls when in May when this happens. But go ahead.
In Florida, I mean, and that could be like a credible national estimate is that approximately, you know, 15 to 18 million people could lose Medicaid eligibility when this process sort of has run its course. That doesn't mean all those people are going to lose coverage, which is something we can talk about, but it's certainly going to be, you know, extremely disruptive. But during just the status quo ante sort of normal life with Medicaid is, you know, states, and they don't do it all the same way. They do it on different time schedules and using different mechanisms, but states periodically, assess the eligibility, the continued eligibility of people enrolled in the program. And you can lose eligibility because your income increases. I mean, people that are in Medicaid because they have disabilities are much less likely to see their eligibility change. But income-based eligibility can change when people's income goes up. But many times people are disenrolled for sort of procedural or just kind of bureaucratic reasons where they're not truly ineligible, but maybe they move and they don't get a piece of mail, or they, don't respond to something in time. And there is a continued occurrence of something that people call churn, which is sort of like going on and off Medicaid by a population of people that are, you know, that are actually eligible the whole time, or maybe they have a tiny fluctuation in income, but quickly they're back into the into a position of eligibility. So what the public health emergency did, the continuous coverage rule, is it eliminated that churn. It kind of just smoothed that out. So people that came into the program weren't disenrolled at any point during this period. And that's why we've kind of sort of stacked up, you know, enrollment's grown and grown. And now we're going to have this process, you know, starting April 1st, where states, using different approaches and with different goals in mind to a certain extent are going to start to reassess all that eligibility. And that's when we're going to see, you know, a lot of people lose their eligibility for Medicaid. And some of that will be sort of mistakes, inappropriate, and lots of those folks will come back on, you know, but not all of them. But the goal, you know, certainly the goal of the federal government is to minimize that inappropriate disenrollment.
When states do this, right? I mean, like, and I don't mean to pick on Florida, but I have no problem picking on Florida. Florida is sort of renowned for having a very difficult unemployment process in which you can claim unemployment. And the theory I have heard, which I think makes a lot of sense, is they don't want to pay out that much. And by slowing the wheels and by, you know, creating obstacles. I mean, we see this in all sorts of like private bureaucracies as well. I mean, you want to claim your insurance, your health insurance. You need to have every form filled out in a weird way that they want it to be to claim your health insurance, and they reject it, and they're making money on the float even if they know they ultimately, and a lot of people just stop pursuing it because it's too difficult, not worth it. With Medicaid, what is the agenda here, and does it change state to state? Like, if you were to sort of categorize, we have some states who just want to drop their rolls as much as possible. We have others that are feeling, you know, budgetary pinches, and want to, you know, reduce their rolls. We have other states that are just, they'll fulfill, you know, they'll try and get as many people on there as possible. I mean, could you classify these states that way? And what is the benefit, if it's a federal program, what's the benefit of a state to kick people off?
Well, I'll just answer that last one really quickly. It's jointly funded by the federal and state government. And, you know, especially in sort of poorer states, the federal government's paying a lot more. And the federal government increased its share during this emergency when it was asking states not to remove anyone from the rolls. But there is a state fiscal component, and that's why, you know, the states that haven't expanded Medicaid yet under the ACA always say that they can't do it, even though study after study after study after study has shown that fiscally they would come out ahead. But there is a state component, and that's something that states will talk about when they talk about their interest in doing this procedure more quickly relatively than more slowly. I think I would say two things. I would say, like, you know, full stop, it's a huge logistical challenge for every single state. There's no playbook for this. There's really no precedent. We have maybe 15 or 18 million people are going to change their coverage status. And that's a volume that's on par with all the people that gained coverage during the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, whether, you know, no matter what your sort of attitude about Medicaid is, it's a huge logistical challenge, and states are going to have to staff up and do all these things. And it's very, very difficult. You know, that being said, I think it's also an opportunity for states to kind of, you know, display their sort of persona about Medicaid. And, you know, some states will act like the most important thing is to sort of get rid of the false positives, you know, remove the people that are on the rolls but not eligible. Other states are going to act like the most important thing is to minimize like the false negatives, you know, like churning people off who shouldn't be churned off. And, you know, will be like more, you know, emphasizing being more deliberative, taking longer, providing more messages, you know, other states. And I think maybe Arkansas has kind of distinguished itself in this way, has really publicized the fact that they want to do this as quickly as possible. And, you know, when they talk about what the objectives are, the thing they'll say first is like maintain the integrity of the Medicaid program. And what they'll say second is, you know, use resources to help the most vulnerable, et cetera. You know, but I would say, you know, one just thing to like, I think for no matter what anybody might say kind of posturally about that, it's a big accountability issue for governors. Like even in Arkansas, like a third of the population is on Medicaid. So I think that if a state is perceived as being reckless or sloppy, not doing a good job, and people are inappropriately disconnected from coverage, people that are getting treated for conditions or need medications, I mean, that's going to be an issue. So I think that even states that are making these kinds of comments, you know, are probably also thinking that there's a lot at stake here, and they need to be careful.
I mean, maybe I'm jaded, but if I'm Sarah Huckabee,
Sanders,
I'm excited to go to next year's CPAC and talk about how many people I kicked off of Medicaid.
I mean, that's I may be a little jaded in that respect. But let me ask you this from a dollar perspective. Like, I mean, when we hear that we're kicking off that, you know, and it depends on how it's executed by the states. So it could be anywhere from 10 to 15 million people. Maybe, I don't know how wide the window is, but that we're kicking people off of health insurance, right? This is Medicaid too. So it's not like there are, you know, and maybe there are people who are making $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 a year who are getting by, you know, staying on Medicaid somehow. They're involved in this and they don't want to pay for health insurance. I'm sure somewhere in the country we could find an example of that. But broadly speaking, the idea that, you know, it's somehow wasteful or fraudulent to have somebody who's making, you know, $1,000 a year annually over you know whatever the depending on what the state is over the threshold just seems just on its face to be just ridiculous that we would uninsure these people because like you say that person's uninsured if they get sick they're going to go to the emergency room the taxpayer is going to be paying. You know, 120% of what they would otherwise be paying, essentially, or whatever the figure is, they're going to be paying more. It's not even fiscally responsible. This is really more an ideological thing on some level, it seems to me. How much money is being saved here after you net out all the administrative costs associated with keeping people off? And then the projections as to how much they're going to cost because 20% of the people you kick off are going to end up in the emergency room probably within the next month or something over the course of next year.
Well, let me say two things. I think you're absolutely right is that the churn is just a deadweight loss. It's terrible for people. It's terrible for the state. It's terrible for the federal government. It's terrible for providers because people are, you know, constantly going on and off the program because of just bureaucratic snafus or just tiny little changes in their income. So I want to lay that out. But just to clarify on the bigger point, these 15 to 18 million people are not going to all become uninsured. You know, most estimates believe that more than half of them are actually either already enrolled in employer insurance or very soon will be. Like maybe their spouses has employer insurance and they're going to pick it up. A lot of people don't even know that they're still enrolled in Medicaid. So it is bad, but it's not quite as bad as that sounds, because that would increase the uninsurance rate nationally by like 50%, but it's not that bad. But we do think that about 20% of these folks, maybe 3-4 million people nationally, will end up uninsured. So that, you know, that's a terrible shame and that's a huge problem because we were at this, you know, historic low with uninsurance thanks to this emergency measure. And it's going to depend on the way states behave and what state officials do to both not inappropriately terminate people and then also try to transition people to either the marketplace or CHIP so that people that do lose eligibility for Medicaid don't end up uninsured. So the goal is to minimize inappropriate terminations and to you know maximize transitions for people that don't have ESI.
Okay, so if it is the case, only 3 or 4 million people and only.
That's a lot
gonna,
of people.
No, that's a lot of people, are going to lose their health insurance because you have other people who could go on to secondary insurance or they could go on to spouse or they could get a job soon. And presumably if they have that insurance available to them, they're more likely to use that one because it probably has more access to providers than Medicaid generally does. In which case they're not costing the Medicaid system really anything. While they're on it because they're not using it. So the expense to throw them off is actually more expensive than the use of their Medicaid. And then presuming that if there's churn and they fall back into it, then you need to administer them back into the program, creating more costs associated with that. But with that said, 3 or 4 million people without insurance, hopefully it's less, hopefully not more. But presuming 3 or 4 million people then, because the others are, it's not savings, right? For the federal government. I mean, if they're not really using Medicaid, or, and maybe there's some that are, but they could be using something else, I guess, and they would be carrying the expense. How much money do we know that is going to be saved?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there are definitely people now that aren't really filing claims or using services. There's still sort of a contract in most states between the state and a managed care organization to, you know, to care for people that are enrolled. And that, I think in many states, that contract has been adjusted to, you know, kind of account for the fact that there are people that are enrolled but aren't really using services. And that's probably because they're enrolled somewhere else, you know, and they're using services somewhere else. Some of them may not even remember that, that at one point they were enrolled in Medicaid. I mean, that's really possible. But I mean, those are kind of non-problems, you know, really compared to people that either are eligible and fall between the cracks. And, you know, we right. know, for example, that the majority of people that are facing this, you know, this bureaucratic nightmare don't even know about it. They're not even aware that this is happening. They're just out there kind of living their lives. They may not even know that the program, the health insurance that they have is called Medicaid. Every state calls these programs something different. And people are just famously uninterested in insurance. You know, they don't want to think about their insurance. They don't want to switch car insurance. They don't want to switch health insurance. Like, they don't want to think about insurance. So these issues that are really consume so many people that think about health insurance all the time, the people that are most affected, I think a lot of them are going to be caught unawares, even though there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of effort to think about how to communicate with people. And that's one of the things that, you know, everybody's really worried about is people not getting messages, not responding, and then sort of falling through the cracks. And hopefully they'll find their way back to Medicaid. But, you know, some of them will have important interruptions in care that will be consequential for them and, you know, may not get back for a while. So that's something that everybody's super worried about.
Well, I'm sorry. I keep pressing on this point. I guess I'm trying to figure out, I mean, there's a statutory obligation, I guess, to kick these people off of Medicare. Is that it? Like, What's the rationale? I mean, Medicaid, I should say. What's the rationale for doing this? I'm trying, like, does anybody have a number? Is there anybody out there going, like, it's going to save the U.S. government $100 billion this year? Or is it just, we're doing this because we're statutorily obligated. We have no option. I mean, what's the point?
Well, I mean, it's you know, kind of a normal thing to routinely assess the eligibility of people for you know, means-tested programs. You know, I mean, I don't think that's crazy. I think it's unfortunate how much the sort of status quo ante practice varied in states and how, like, consumer unfriendly it often is and how hard it is for people. We suspended all that during the pandemic, which I think was great because it boosted coverage. And you know, now we're going to go back to, you know, back to the normal, which I understand the reason for doing it, but the practice in which it takes place is often, you know, really, you know, puts people at a disadvantage, and people often lose coverage inadvertently. And that's just been this kind of cost that we've come to accept, you know, churn and Medicaid, but it's, you know, it's sort of bad for everybody. So we're, you know, kind of back to that again.
I still don't understand. I mean, I get that we're going back to normal. Normal was bad. We agree that normal was bad because of churn. I'm just curious, is like anybody out there going, like, we need to get back to normal because we're going to save X or Y?
Well, I mean, we need to get back to normal because those are the rules of our sort of normal healthcare system, which I think a lot of people could say is, you know, very fragmented, very complicated, very difficult for people, and, you know, leaves a lot of us uncovered. So I think if you said, gee, wouldn't it be great if we just had like one single system that was so much easier for people to participate in, then we wouldn't have all these problems to begin with. And we wouldn't have had to have erect all these measures during the pandemic. And then we wouldn't have to go back to the same system. I mean, I think that that's a very reasonable thing to say. And in fact, there's some states that are so kind of, you know, tired and sick of seeing these people like just making, you know, a little bit too much for Medicaid and falling out and not having another option or not being able to afford going into the marketplace or whatever, that they've created things like basic health plans, or they've really made double down on efforts to, like, say for a population like kids, to like not redetermine their eligibility for long periods of time, to not interrupt coverage for people. So I do think that there are lots of people that sort of hate this aspect of the normal, where we redetermine people's eligibility, and we are often, you know, either because they missed a message or because they have a slight change in their income, which is still very low, you know, turning people out of their health insurance coverage, which nobody likes.
So how does North Carolina fit into this, right? I mean, they are what, they became the 40th state to expand.
Right.
I'm just curious about that particular set of circumstances into the larger Medicaid ecosystem here.
Well, I mean, it's great news. And, you know, estimated 600,000 people, I think, will gain coverage in North Carolina. That's one of the bigger states that hadn't expanded. Obviously, Texas, Florida, Georgia, other, you know, really big states where there are a lot of people in the so-called coverage gap, which is, you know, one of the sort of cruelest things about our healthcare system, where there are people who are too poor for the marketplace, so they're not allowed to go to the marketplace, but then they have no other option, and their option is to be uninsured until these states expand Medicaid, which is something that, you know, would just be, you know, wonderful if all the states would do. So it's great news that North Carolina is expanding Medicaid, and we certainly would love to see the other states make the same decision. How does it affect the unwinding issue? I mean, it's going to take place a little bit later. It's kind of separate. I think, you know, in the expansion states, you know, thinking again about kind of the metaphor of the front door and the back door, in the expansion states, the front door is a little bigger because there are more ways that people can be eligible for Medicaid. So, you know, the back door might be a little bigger too when it opens, and we might see sort of more disenrollment of low income adults in expansion states in general, but they're more likely to have someplace to go because those states, you know, employers make more offers. And, you know, I think that like New York, for example, has a basic health plan, and there's more options for adults. I think in the non-expansion states, we're going to see a little bit less of that because fewer of those folks are eligible to begin with because they haven't expanded Medicaid, and we're going to see a lot of children, and most of those children should be eligible for CHIP, you know, but there is a concern that you know, even some kids could fall through the cracks if there's not sufficient outreach.
3 to 4 million you anticipate will be out of insurance after all of this is said and done. How many children? I would imagine much less, because there are CHIP programs that sort of like catch them when they fall out of this Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, I think you know, the child uninsurance rate now is something like 3.7%, which is super low, and you know, that's something that is a big achievement. And I think there's always going to be a prioritization for keeping children covered, and you know, even in states that haven't expanded Medicaid to low-income adults, they have CHIP programs with, you know, reasonable eligibility. So there's certainly a hope that we're not going to see a lot of children lose coverage. But I mean, I don't think it's crazy to think that some will. And there's certainly linkages between children's coverage and adults' coverage. So when adults lose coverage, sometimes we see kids lose coverage, and, you know, parents and children, and sort of the reverse can be the same. So I think that it's certainly a concern. But there is the CHIP mechanism, which is helpful for kids.
Kathy Hempstead, Senior Policy Advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This conversation would have been so much easier if we just had some form of Medicaid for All or Medicare for All. We wouldn't have had anything.
We wouldn't have the conversation. You know, I mean, no. I think that the public health emergency, in, you know, there's things about it that weren't equity promoting, but I think the flexibilities around health insurance were things that really did promote more equity and give more people access to healthcare and coverage. And now, unfortunately, we're about to kind of erect all of the barriers to that we had before the pandemic.
I could only imagine if we had folks from, you know, European listeners listening to this conversation, just completely bewildered that we can be sitting here going like, good news is only 4% of our children don't have health insurance. I mean, it's just nuts. But thank you so much for walking us through it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks. That is it for the first half of the program. And I will be leaving on a jet plane, as it were. I am headed down.
Have you revealed the reason? Okay.
Yes, I mentioned this yesterday. I'm going down to Florida. I cannot tell you how much I like have asked myself in the past 12 hours, like, why am I doing this? But it was, I have Thursdays off, and I didn't have a dentist appointment or the haircut, and I don't have the kids this week, and I don't know. Somehow I thought, like, oh, well, I'll see Florida. But I realize now, like, I'm not going to see anything in Florida. I'm going to get down there. It's going to be nighttime. First thing in the morning, I go to Patrick Bette David's studio, and then I go right from the studio back onto the plane to get back here for an
inexplicable decision. I mean, to not just stay in the warmth for like one more day at least.
I don't know what I was thinking.
You have such little faith in us to run the show. I mean, I think that must be it.
No, I don't know if it's like some type of like, I don't know, I felt bad like going down to Florida, but like, I'm also, what am I going to do?
You're going to DeSantis's Florida? You're not,
yeah, you're not boycotting?
Well, I'm there, so I won't spend any money. How's that? Down there.
Yeah.
Famished by the time you
get. I'm bringing my own food.
Oh,
I'm bringing like 4 or 5 turkey sandwiches. And,
yeah, shout out to whoever's sitting next to you on that airplane.
Yes,
exactly.
A bag of hard-boiled eggs.
Exactly.
And then just straight liquid IV.
But that's my normal. That's my normal eating patterns.
Yeah.
I'd just be like, I'd give you one, but I don't. I'm not.
Are you one of those guys
in Florida?
Are you one of those guys
who eats a sandwich on the?
No, you bring. Do you bring eggs on the plane? Do you bring
smelly food on the plane?
No.
Oh, thank God. Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Who would do that? Who would open up an egg on the plane?
Plenty of assholes. Plenty of people. One time I was sitting on a plane. My sister was next to me. And a guy, I look in between the armrests. And there's 3 dirty toes. And the guy was like cramming his bare foot in between. I have a picture of it. In between where we were sitting. Yeah. So people do crazy
bad things. Would happen to those toes if I saw them. I can assure
I
you. Like let's see. Disgusting. Oh, didn't Rush give up the ghost last time Sam went down to Florida? You know, as a total coincidence. Did that happen?
I think.
I mean, you went to Disney since then. I think, right? Mm-hmm. Or was that the same trip? I don't know.
May have been the same trip.
But then the Ukraine. But then Rush invaded Ukraine. So prepare for big news tomorrow.
That's right. Well, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah, right. There we go.
Trump indictment tomorrow. You can bank on it, folks. I will not be here. So enjoy coverage of that. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. I should also say, I'm not paying for any of this trip. That was the other part. Mm. Like, just like the idea that, I did hear like, oh, free travel down to Florida. He's putting me up. And then it just didn't occur to me, like, is this really going to be fun?
Mm-hmm.
And that part, like, I'm too slow on certain things, but it should be interesting conversation with the guy. I don't really know much about him, to be honest. I'm starting to watch some of the interviews he's done in the past. I don't know. He's huge. He does huge numbers. I don't know how I hadn't heard about him, but again, you could bring in every single person who won an Oscar. And put them right in front of me right now. And I would just be like, why are these people here?
I'll never forget you not knowing that like Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt were together. That was,
I did know that they were together.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Didn't they break up?
Yeah.
All right.
Pretty,
see, there you go.
Pretty big deal. Wow. Yeah.
What's happening with Brangelina?
They also broke up.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
All right. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, you also get the free half, free of commercials. And then in the fun half, you can IM Emma today if you have the app at majorityapp.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I will sign off and see you guys on Friday. And Emma, ESVN as I exit. Bye, Bradley. Bye, Matt.
Bye. Bye, Sam. Have fun. On ESPN, we spoke about week one of NFL free agency, March Madness upsets, the Aaron Rodgers drama explained, and more. YouTube.com/ESPN show. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning last night, we had Danny Bessner on to talk about his fascism piece, and we also touched on Ted Lasso being at the White House.
So, like, mental health is just a thing we say now, right?
It's a thing we just all got to take seriously, and we all got to do our part and pitch in like it's litter or something.
Yeah, right, right. We all have to just, yeah, collectively understand that mental health is an issue and then apparently not do anything about nationalizing our healthcare.
It was kind of a fascinating event because during it, one of the only like African news reporters in the press corps started yelling at Karine Jean-Pierre with the cast of Ted Lasso behind her because he hasn't gotten a question in 7 months. And so, like, it's just like Jason Sudeikis and Brett Goldstein and Brendan McDonald just like standing there while this guy's like, Karine, you never call on me.
I mean, that's so an awkward situation.
It was all around like a kind of weird thing to go on.
Yeah, I mean, we should actually play it in the fun half.
Yeah, yeah, I'll get the clip.
I think fine. Like, watch what you want. And I think, like, you know, Ted Lasso is a polarizing show, but I think if you enjoy it, enjoy it. But like, there's a internet dad desire phenomenon that like is very disturbing to me.
Why? I mean, it's a little weird.
We got to be adults here. Like, yes. This thing where like this fictional character comes and says like, "Oh, it's actually Ted Lasso himself," and everyone pretends like it's fucking Santa Claus at the mall, and oh, he has some deep things to say. I mean, we'll talk about it in the fun half. But anyway,
I know it's just, but like, even I don't love the sexual. Like, why are we sexualizing Pedro Pascal as a society? And like, that's totally normal, but that's a whole different thing.
I have no idea who Pedro Pascal is.
The guy from what? See, we're in different media circles right here. But yes, I think you're right. They're one and the same. He's the guy from Last of Us and the Mike.
No, I haven't seen that yet, but like
I didn't like The Last of Us, but
We also talked about in the post game, we talked about Minnesota passing school lunch and breakfast. Bernie talking about the primary in his new book about Elizabeth Warren failing to endorse him, even though she should have. And Tucker Carlson supposedly cares about truckers. I think people are taking that clip. I mean, you saw that clip of Tucker Carlson and Ben Shapiro.
Yes,
arguing,
I did.
But we talked about that, and I, you know,
I don't know how people aren't missing that he's being reactionary.
Yeah, I mean,
it's kayfabe.
Like, it's also like the I think people are right to point out that he's like, he basically set up Ben Shapiro as the Jewish guy looking to take all your. I don't think that was. I don't think that was beneath Tucker's awareness. But we talked about that and, you know, what the actual message about something like AI should be or self-driving. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. We went for about 2 hours in the post game last night, so you're going to want to get that.
All right. Well,
we also talked about Jimmy Dore, David Sachs.
Oh, wow. Packed. All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.